the first thing I want to do is to thank you. To thank you for being there. To thank you for being there for so many women who have nowhere to go, have no one to help, who live in communities that deny what is happening right in the apartment next to them, in the house down the street, in the house down the lane. I thank you for being there for women who need help. When we talk about battery, we are not talking about something that only happens to a few women. We're talking about something that happens to possibly as many as half of the married women in the United States. That is staggering. It is staggering to understand that the place where a woman is most at jeopardy is, in fact, in her own home. That 4,000 women a year in the United States are killed in their own homes, not by strangers who break in, but by men who presumably love them. It is urgent to understand what is, and I use the word in quotes, but I use it seriously, what is normal about battery. Why it doesn't seem to the husband, often to the wife, to the neighbors, to the families, why it doesn't seem that something unbelievably disastrous and terrible is happening when a woman is being beaten. Why is that? And when I say that battery is normal, what I mean is that battery expresses a lot of attitudes and opinions that people have about women, including that women have about women. And it also expresses a power relationship between men and women that is taken to be not only normal and commonplace, but correct, the right relationship. That it's appropriate that men have power over women. That it's appropriate that men have certain kinds of control over women's lives, especially over the lives of women that they're married to, or women that they live with, women with whom they are, quote unquote, intimate. I come from a time being older than you could possibly imagine. When you all and I did not exist. When there was no recognition at all that a woman who was being beaten, tortured, on the verge of being murdered, needed help. For those of you who remember, remember now. For those of you who never knew, try to imagine. It was her fault. She did deserve it. She brought it on herself. If she weren't bad, it wouldn't be happening. And as far as she knew, the person to whom it was happening, it wasn't happening to anybody else in the world. She was the only one who was being treated this way by her husband. Because we didn't talk about battery. Battery did not have a social existence. It was a private, secret nightmare for women who had nowhere to turn. And when women asked for help, they were told exactly what I said to you. It's your fault. Look to yourself. What are you doing wrong? Do it right. Well, of course he got angry. You didn't do the laundry right. He works hard all day. Well, he's very upset. There's a recession on. Well, of course when he comes home at night, he doesn't want his peas on that side of the plate. Of course not, fool. And his response may or may not have been a little bit excessive. But hey, he's under a lot of pressure. Hey, he doesn't know the meaning of the word pressure. I want to remind you what the experience of battery is, because we become cold to it. And especially those who work in social services, you see so many people, you deal with so many situations. You're dealing with what happens at the moment. And maybe screaming out to survive yourself sometimes what has really been happening to the woman day in and day out. And why it is that for her, there's never a moment of freedom from the pressure that she is under. Being battered is being hit, yes. It is being hit a lot, yes. It is being hit so that you hurt, yes. It is being hit so that sometimes the bruises show and sometimes they don't show, yes. And sometimes it is being hit by someone who is very skilled and knows how to hit, has learned through hitting other women, has learned by learning on the woman he's hitting now. Women are battered by policemen who are trained in how the human body responds to pain, by doctors who know where the kidney is and where the spleen is. But being battered is also being a captive. And this is the part that's urgent to understand. When you look at what happens to women in battery, the only place that you see the kind of systematic injuries, physical and psychological injuries that come from battery, are in prisons where people are tortured. And virtually everything now that we know about how to help people who have been tortured in prisons under situations of political repression comes from what we have learned by studying what is done to battered women. Because in the home, the situation that's created is virtually the same. Now, why should it be that in a home, a woman is a prisoner, a woman is a captive, a woman is in a nightmare that she can't get out of? I mean, there are a lot of reasons. There are a lot of reasons for that. Some of them are economic. Some of them are social. Some of them have to do with the inability of the neighbors to hear the scream. A lot of them have to do with fear of the man who's hurting the woman. Hey, you don't want him coming after you. Better you should not know what is happening to her. And before the existence of all of you, when she would turn to other people and ask for help, not only was it her fault, but most of the time they would deny that it was even happening. Surely she was misunderstanding, misinterpreting, misrepresenting, misexpressing, making a terrible mistake. And the terrible mistake was not that she was with the man who was hurting her. It was that she was complaining about it. When you are battered, over time, you are physically tortured. Now, I want you to understand what I mean. I'm not speaking in hyperbole. I don't mean that you're hurt very, 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 very bad. I don't mean that it's a very bad thing that you're being hurt, although it's a very bad thing. I mean that batterers purposefully, seriously torture the women that they're hurting. They do it physically. Sometimes they use degrees of force that are almost unconscionable to believe that it's possible. For instance, hitting a woman with a big wooden beam, using knives on a woman, using a baseball bat on a woman. Sometimes the woman is tied up and tortured, and it is called sex when she is hurt. She is often sleep deprived, purposefully, the way she would be if she were in a prison. He takes her life and he messes with it in order to fracture it, to break it into little pieces so that she has no life left. Now, the effects of sleep deprivation on prisoners who are being tortured aren't any different than the effects of sleep deprivation on women. What does it mean to have a life as a sovereign human being when your body belongs to someone else such that you can't get a night's sleep? Your perceptions become distorted. And you ask for help and you're told that your perceptions are distorted. And you say, right, I haven't slept in however long. Some of it is purposeful. A woman is let to sleep for 20 minutes, and then 20 minutes, and then 20 minutes, and then 20 minutes. Each piece of sleep interrupted by some kind of an assault. Sometimes day in and day out, for weeks, for months. The power of the batterer is in his fists. It's in his money, it's in his social power, but it is also in his apparent irrationality. It is in the fact that the woman who is being hurt cannot anticipate what he will do next. What he will do next to her, what he will do next to someone else, to a child, or frankly, to a dog, to a cat, to whatever she loves, whomever she loves, what he will do next, she doesn't know. If she stands up to him, she will be hurt. If she submits to him, she will still be hurt. When you live in a world that's governed by laws you don't understand and can't understand, you can be destroyed mentally by that world. No human being can live being subjected to the irrational hatred of another person in intimacy, in their private life. It's hard enough if you have to deal with prejudice in the social world, on the street. It's hard enough if you're going to be beaten up because your skin is the wrong color, because you have the wrong partner, the wrong sexed partner by your side. That's hard enough. But when in your intimate life you are going to be hurt and you don't know why, and you don't know when, and you don't know how, the only thing you know is that if not today, it will be tomorrow. It will drive you mad. And then they will say, aha, you see, she was mad. The fear that the battered woman experiences is beyond the power of any language I have to express to you. Because it is a fear of a recrimination that is on the one hand total. The man controls the total universe of the woman. And on the other hand, it has to do with every little detail of her life. It is a punishment for anything at any time, and therefore one lives in an ocean of fear. One swims and swims and swims and swims and swims and thinks, so what if I keep swimming? And when will this stop? And God, help me. Help me. Let me die. And that is what happens to battered women who do not get away. That is what happens. They say, they pray. I will tell you, they pray to die. Because it seems peaceful, and it seems better, and it probably is better. There is a kind of humiliation that goes with battered, being battered. That is very deep. It is very deep because, number one, one knows that one has done something wrong or it would not be happening. One believes that. A woman has been told that all of her life, basically that she is responsible for the behaviors of the men around her. And therefore, when this is happening to her, there is an internalized part that we all have, and I don't care what your ideology is, I don't care how militantly feminist or not you are, I don't care how deeply religious you are, there is a part that says, it's my fault, I did it. And there is an extraordinary sense of humiliation in not being able to stand up as a simple human being with dignity. But there's also something deeper, and that's a shame. It's a kind of shame that I believe only people in captivity can feel. When you are forced to do things that are incredibly degrading to you. And one thing that is incredibly degrading is to follow the orders of somebody else just because they give them, just because you're afraid. In other words, to experience within yourself a complete lack of self-respect, so bottomless that there is no self there to find, to respect. And that's a consequence of being battered. This all happens in a situation of intimacy. This happens not because the Nazis have marched into town and taken over your home. It doesn't happen because there's a plundering horde coming from somewhere else. It happens with someone, presumably, that you're with because you care about them, you love. Maybe you decided to have children together. Maybe you had a feeling of friendship for them. But you're with them for reasons of intimacy. They matter to you. You care about them. And partly you're there because you think that they care about you. We have a very skewed standard for loving and caring for women. We have a double standard, which is to say, a man can show how much he cares by being violent. See, he's jealous, he cares. A woman shows how much she cares by how much she's willing to be hurt, by how much she will take, how much she will endure, how suicidal she's prepared to be. In all these years, thinking about battery, having experienced it, talking to other women, there is one form of self-blame that I feel, and that when I look at women, I think is true. I think the Christians call it the sin of pride. And the pride in this situation for women is that we believe that for the sake of love, we can endure anything. And we make it a point of pride to endure anything. We cannot, we must not, we should not. Our shoulders do not have to carry that weight. No, they don't. We do not bear the burden of all the love in the world, such that we are annihilated for the sake of somebody else's life, or for the more selfish sake of proving that we're really good women, that we're really good, honest, loving mates, that really we didn't deserve it. Look, we're still here. Yes, he did something terrible, but look, here we are, prepared still to love him. There is an ideology to romance that says, basically, that force, the use of force, is an expression of strong feeling for a woman. that when a man uses various gradations of force against her, what he's doing is expressing his very deep desire for her. Most of us have been taught that in one form or another. Some of us have learned it through our religions. Some of us have learned it through popular culture. Some of us have seen Gone with the Wind 4,000 times. It is everywhere. We measure his desire by what he's willing to do to her, and we celebrate the force that he's willing to show. And then, when she shows up in a pile of bleeding bones in an emergency room hospital, we say, oh, that wasn't so romantic after all. No, it wasn't. And it wasn't from the beginning. And that's what we have to understand. It wasn't romantic from the very, very start, when it just looked like, hey, God, he really wants her a lot. There is, in romance, in sexual relations, there is an implicit, not an accidental, a purposeful, a systematic sense of ownership, of how men own women. Sexuality can be an expression of that. It can be an expression of physical ownership of women. So, we have the experience of being battered, and the husband is doing the same things as a torturer would do. He's doing the same things as an assassin would do, but he's the husband. We're not allowed to say bad things about him. We're not even allowed to say bad things about him when he's actively brutalizing a woman. And when he does it in front of our eyes, we turn around, most of us, and walk away. Hey, and it's not that we say nothing. No. We say bad things, but we say them about her. It is easy to say that men beat women in order to express domination, to exercise control. These are easy sentences to say. But I need to ask you to think about what they really mean. We're talking about people who live together. We're talking about 24 hours a day. We're talking about the woman's body. We're talking about control of every function of her body. We're talking about how she dresses. We're talking about how she walks. We're talking about, yes, whether she uses the toothpaste from the middle or the bottom. We are often in intimate relations, and I want you to think about it. It's important. We're talking about how much toilet paper she uses. We are talking about every aspect of her behavior that an adult should decide for herself. Any definition of what it means to be a sovereign human being includes the most bizarre, ordinary fact of life. Yes, I decide how to do that. To the larger questions of where do I go? How late do I stay out? Women in this country who are battered are under a curfew. The curfew is imposed by a policeman. The policeman is the husband. Adult human beings decide who their friends are. They decide who they want to talk to. They decide what books they want to read and what movies they want to go see. And if they want to go see a movie and their partner doesn't, and they decide to go alone, that's what they do. That's what being an adult is in the most ordinary sense. But most women don't exercise those simplest expressions of freedom. And it's not just because we're afraid to go out after dark because of the men we're not married to. Although we have reason enough for that. When we political people talk about male supremacy, we talk about it in large ways. We talk about patterns of violence against women. We talk about female poverty and its meaning in a woman's life. But when we talk about battery, we have to remember that we are talking about every aspect of a human life, every single day, all the time. Thomas Jefferson did not consider these problems of freedom. Our Constitution does not address them. Women were chattel when the Constitution was written. African American women and men were slaves. I want you to understand how important this is. The problem of human freedom has never been considered from the point of view of a woman's life. There isn't any system of government anywhere in the world predicated on the notion that if a woman isn't free, no one is free. There isn't any political science anywhere in the world that says, in a way that matters, that the primary concern about human freedom has to be about the lives of women and children, because they're the ones who haven't had freedom. Cross-culturally and trans-historically, that is true. When we talk about what men do to women, we are, many of us, treated, number one, of course, as if we're making it up. We're not making it up. More than most people, you understand that we're not making it up. And not only are we not making it up, we're so careful not to exaggerate it. We're so careful to fight for our credibility and to protect it. We're so careful to have to prove what we say. We know we're going to have to prove it. So if we know that one out of two women is being beaten, but we can only prove that in some cities in the country, one out of 25 women's being beaten. That's what we say. We say one out of 25. We don't say one out of two. And when we say whatever it is we say, the FBI comes back to us and says, that doesn't happen. When the women's movement first started talking about battered women, we were told that doesn't happen by law enforcement people, by the FBI, by sociologists who now make all their money getting grants to study battery. Yes, they discovered that it happens. And the FBI now says that battery is the most commonly committed violent crime in the United States. Yes, we were right. And we were right for a very simple reason, which is we listen to the people to whom it happens. We listen to women. We believe what women say. We know that when you see a situation of terror and you hear about it over and over and over and over and over and over again, that it's not likely that each woman is making it up. That there are characteristics of this terror that we can look at and understand, and we see that they're systematic, which is to say they happen to all the women who are being hurt. But we're very careful. So we said women were being raped, and we were told that that wasn't true. Every now and then there was a psychotic killer. But hey, not very often. And in fact, something like one out of three women in the United States is in some way sexually abused, actually before she becomes an adult. An adult. So we have the experiences of women. And we take them seriously. We also have history, which is actually not a matter of opinion. Women were legally property. We were legally chattel. White women were legally chattel in the United States. White women, the racially superior women in a racist country, were at the top of a pile and belonged to the men who owned them. They didn't own the clothes on their back. Guardianship of their children passed to another male if the husband died. Intercourse was a right of marriage. That is to say, the woman wasn't just owned as a piece of property. If she was a married woman, and I say with the exception of slavery, because slavery is a very, very important central phenomenon in this country, and the experiences of African American women in relation to marriage have been different, because the slave owner owned both the woman and the man. But if we take what we consider the quote unquote the normative experience, which is the white experience, then what we see is that part of the ownership of women was that women were owned not just the outside, but inside. We were owned, and intercourse was part of what went with us. The right of sexual access to us is part of the way in which we were owned. And the children that we had were owned as property by the man who owned us. Now, the reason that this remains important, even though it has changed somewhat, is that laws about marital rape have not changed enough. When a woman was owned in marriage, and intercourse was a male right because he owned the woman, she was his wife, that's what it meant, that he had a sexual right to her. He couldn't rape her, because anything he did to her was his right to do. When we take a stand and say, if you force a woman to have sex inside marriage, that is rape, we are saying you cannot own a woman in marriage. You do not own her body. You don't own it outside and you don't own it inside. That is an urgent political stand for us to take. The fact of the matter is that the sense of possession that husbands have over wives, the sense of entitlement, the sense of right, the sense of, I have a right to do to her what I want to do. Leave me alone. Why are you bothering me? This isn't your business. If I hurt her, I hurt her. It's like my car. If I want to drive my car into a brick wall, I drive it into a brick wall. What business is it of yours? That attitude used to be grounded in law. And now, we have a little bit of distance from that, but not enough. And I think that when we look at male culture and what men say about women, and when we talk to battered women, we can say that when men have sex with women, they feel a sense of entitlement and ownership and superiority that goes beyond what any adult human being has a right to feel about another adult human being. Which is to say that this movement has got to take a stand and say that men do not have sexual rights to women's bodies. And this movement has to understand, when you see women who are hurt coming to you and you're thinking, this is so irrational, this is so insane, why is this happening? What is driving this man? Part of what is driving him is that he has had intimate sexual relations with this woman, and from his point of view, she belongs to him. And if you want to get in the way of that, you get in the way of that at threat to yourself. It is a very big mistake to think that you can do anything about battery if you will not look at the common assumptions in it about men and women, at what is, what I called at the beginning, normal, ordinary, and part of what is normal and ordinary is that a man feels a right of sexual possession over a woman. And he has a long historical reason for feeling it, and he really, really believes it to be true. We are changing that. And the change means that there is a lot of social conflict. A lot of men are angry that we are changing that. A lot of women are afraid because we are changing that. But it is going to change. It will change. It has to change. If it doesn't change, men will continue to batter women because they will continue to feel that they have the right, an implicit God-given right, to own that person over there because of the sexual relationship that the man had with the woman. One of the experiences that battered women have is that they run away. They run away, and they go back, and they run away, and they go back, and they run away, and they go back. And there didn't used to be shelters anywhere. Anyone who wanted to help a battered woman was going to have to deal with the anger of the man. Now, because there's some state support for shelters, the state stands a little bit, not between the man and the woman, no, but between the man and whoever is helping the woman. I want to explain something to you about the experience of running away so that maybe for those of you who find it bewildering, you will have some idea of what it means to run away and then go back, decide to go back. Most women have the idea that when they get married and they live in a house and they clean the house and they take care of the house and they, you know, buy pretty things for the house and fix the house up, that it's their home. They have this dumb idea. And it's amazing how much human beings want a home to live in. And so a woman makes a home, quote unquote, a homemaker. She makes a home where she and her husband and their children will live together. She may also be working, she may not be working, quote unquote working. I mean, in this time of social transition, we're talking about so many experiences that are changing. That's the good part. The hard part is to try to keep track of the ways in which they're changing so that we know what's happening around us. Of course she works. She works all the time. She may be doing paid labor outside the home. But, regardless, she thinks she has a home. And when she runs away, she has reached the point of deciding, understanding, believing that she cannot stay one more second. She may run away because a particular outburst of violence has been too terrible to stand. She may be very badly hurt when she runs away. She may run away because she's had a period of peace and she feels stronger and she thinks she can run away. But most women leave at moments of high desperation. At moments when the husband goes for the children, at moments when she believes she's going to be killed, and then she gets out there and still, even with the battered women's movement, there still is no place for most women to go in this country. I mean, I come from New York City. It's a big city. The police, the statistics I know, 2 years ago got a quarter of a million phone calls, just to the police, that a woman was being beaten. There are in New York City 429 beds for women who are battered. Most places of the country are not better than that. So there's not necessarily anywhere to go, even though you are trying to make a place and have made some places for women to go. So she runs away, and she's desperate, and she's probably just been hurt. She may have children, she may have money, she may not have money, but even if she has money, the double standard again, she won't have access to the money. The money might be in the bank, but within 24 hours, it's going to be his, not hers. Because, see, he's not desperate and bleeding. He knows what to do. And she gets out there, and there are a whole lot of other men on the street. And she's vulnerable, and she doesn't have money. And one way or another, they come after her. They come after her to pick her up. They come after her to flirt. They come after her to help her. Help her, meaning usually an exchange of something she needs for something they want. Which is to say that when she leaves this home that she thought she had, she goes out into a land with predators in it who are glad she's there because she's vulnerable. And when she's out there, she starts remembering that she had a home. And she starts thinking that she has a right to have a home. She may even get angry at the man who hurt her and took her home away from her. And somehow or another, she will, in her mind, find a way to reclaim the home that she believes she has a right to. But there's nothing straightforward in society for her to do. I mean, she can't go to a court and say, look, I am a homemaker. I made the home. I would like to live there. You see, I bought the curtains. I did this. I did that. She is suddenly homeless. And the power, the desire, the feeling of having a right to be there is very often what sends women back into trying to make deals with the batterer. Because when the woman goes back, she has to cut a deal. She has to say, I'm sorry, I left. She has to say, it was my fault, I didn't mean it. She has to say, you were right. And if she says all of those things convincingly enough, and if he wants her to come back for whatever his reasons are, she will then have a home. But what will have happened to her? She will have had the experience of submission, real submission. That's what submission is. Humiliation. I am down on my knees. Please take me back. And please take me back sometimes just means let me inside. I need a place to live. And you're my best chance. Please take me back. We see women entering into bargains. Entering into bargains in which, basically, they are giving up any possibility of physical safety in order to have a place to live, in order to have food on the table for their children. And part of what I'm trying to say to you about this is that it's not just the money deal. It's not just the economic deal. It's that we do have a right to a home, don't we? I mean, don't we, really? When is there a time in an adult woman's life when this society says, a woman, yes, a woman without a man, has a right to a home on her own terms? She has a right to live in some kind of dignity with some kind of safety. So I'm also trying to say to you that the situation of battery can't be solved if we don't understand in this society that a woman actually does have a right to have a home. We're a homeless people unless we enter into a relationship with a man for a home. I am not speaking to you about not entering into relationships with men. I am saying that those relationships need to be chosen in real freedom. And that freedom requires that a person have the basics of life. And that women are people. And that we too deserve on our own, without more, to have the basics of life. When a woman runs away, she finds out that she wanted it all along. It may be the most shocking news she'll ever get in her life. That in fact, if she goes to a therapist, the therapist is likely to tell her even today that she did the things she did in order to be hurt. Her priest, her minister, her rabbi are likely to tell her the same thing. Her family doctor is liable to tell her the same thing. One hopes no one at the shelter will tell her the same thing. But there are incidences and times when that has happened. Because this is an all-pervasive ideology about women, that what makes us distinct from other people is that we are really craving this kind of attention from men, and that therefore we provoke it because we're looking for pain. And there's an underlying philosophy here that says that we're basically masochistic, that the masochism is sexual. And part of what that means is, yes, that when men hurt us, it's not really the same kind of problem as if a man were to kidnap a man and hurt him. Because we don't say when a man hurts another man that the second man enjoyed it. We don't say it was a sexual experience for him. We don't say that something in his nature craved it. Otherwise, why would he have been a drunken fool in that bar and said the things that he said to the first man? No matter what men do to provoke violence, we don't say it's in the nature of men to provoke violence. No matter how much male-on-male violence we see in our society, we don't say, God, how come these men, not just like beating up other people, how come they like being beaten up? But with women, whenever we're hurt, suddenly there's an explanation in place. Now, part of what this does is to make us second class in a very, very, very serious way, because it means that there's a different standard of what's appropriate. For women, there's a different standard of dignity. For instance, when a man and woman are married and she's hit the first time, not the 14th time, the first time, and she goes to her family and she says, he hit me, do they say, move out, your rights have been violated? They are not likely to. The advice that she will get is that it's her role and her nature both to take care of him and implicitly to accept the pain. It's bad advice. Move out the first time. The issue here is the rights of human beings. And if you understand that women are human beings, you must say, what is the right an honorable and proper way for this person to be treated by this person? Now, When feminists do that, we're told, well, we don't pay any attention to gender. You know, we're not all people. We're men and we're women, and that's it. We pay a hell of a lot of attention to gender. That's why we look at rape and battery and try to do something about it, because these are crimes against human beings that happen because of gender prejudice, of a prejudice against women, a hatred of women that we do not deserve, that we have not earned, that no one has a right to act out on us. But we internalize a lot of it, and we settle for second best because we know we can't have day-to-day real equality. And we try to cut our losses, and we cut our deals, and we do the best that we can, and women keep getting beaten. I want to say that inside a marriage in which there's this kind of violence and this kind of emotional abuse, which goes with the violence, people in the battered women's movement, feminists, all of us, have been very reluctant to say that we are talking about rape within marriage when we talk about women having sex with their husbands in these situations, right? I'm going to speak to you first person. This is my opinion. It is my opinion that when a woman is being brutalized, when a woman is being hit, when a woman is being tortured, when a woman is being intimidated, that when the man has sex with her, he is raping her. She is in a continuous situation of force. The fact that the force was not applied at the moment before intercourse does not mean that the intercourse was engaged in freely. In fact, freedom is a sick joke in this circumstance, and so is the notion of consent. There is no freedom when a woman is living in a situation in which day in and day out her bread and her water are intimidation, brutality, and pain. Now, I would like to see us stop trying to be so damn civil about all of this to the people who are hurting us. I would like for us to stop having to think that we need to prove to them anything. Anything! Anything! They need to prove to us that they can respect our lives enough to make social policy that stops battering. And as long as battering is going on, the woman who is being battered is also being raped. And that is the truth from my point of view. And I would like to see us not gloss over it, because every time we do gloss over it, we tell basically a fundamental lie about what is happening to the woman. And we also make stronger the unspoken assumptions about the sex is fine and the battery is something different. The battery is not exactly something different. They are related. And the ways in which they're related is part of what I'm talking about, and it's very important. The whole notion of possession is the way in which they're related. When I think about escape, and I think about it now very, very much, I told Judy Reeves when we spoke on the phone recently, 20 years ago this week, in the next week and a half, I made an escape, not from the home in which I was battered. I had done that already and still found an assassin husband ready to beat me up every time I turned a corner, breaking into the house. All of the things that you know, where the pursuit continues beyond the point when the woman leaves the home. No, I escaped in the middle of the night. I ran away, and I ran to a different country. And had I not, I don't believe I would be alive. I don't believe that I would be. And as many of you will know, the current research shows that women are in more danger when they leave than when they're actually in the home. More danger of being killed. And I want you to think about it, because if there is a description of a no-win situation, that's it. Escape only means some things. You continue to live a life in which someone wants to hurt you. And the only time you get any relief from living that life is if he finds another woman he wants to hurt. There's not a lot of solace in that. What do we do about the batterers? This question is an urgent one. You pull them off of one woman, they find another woman. There aren't individual solutions to this problem, although every woman's life that's saved is a victory of sorts. What I'm trying to say here is that escape is always only partial. That women who have been battered often remain hunted. It's not just that we stay frightened, which we do. It's not just that we have nightmares, which we do. It's not just that we have flashbacks in which everything is real and happening right now instead of in the past, which we do. But it's that he's out there. He is somewhere. He is hurting someone. And if he's not, it's sort of an accident. I mean, it's for some reason that doesn't have anything to do with justice. You didn't get any justice. You may have gotten away, but you didn't get justice. It doesn't have to do with freedom. You may have gotten away, but you didn't get freedom because he's out there. I ask myself the question, what is freedom for a battered woman? What is that? Initially, it's just not being hit. It's anything, anything that will stop you from being hit. That's incredible freedom. It's amazing. You go through a day and nobody hits you. You go through 2 days and nobody hits you. You go through a week and you haven't been hit and you can barely believe it. But then you want to walk down the street and you don't know where he is. Are you free? No, you're not free. I have come to think that we can't talk about what is freedom for women without talking about what is freedom for battered women. And to me, that means that every woman who is or has been battered has to have, in our society, a real right of sovereignty over her body. It has to be real. There have to be boundaries that she can set, that every single person is legally bound to respect, and if they don't, they will be punished for it. No exceptions. They will be punished for it. A woman has a right to safety, in real life, not abstractly. And a lot has to change before that's possible. All the implicit assumptions about women's inferiority have to change. And that means that you, in addition to the work you do, have to look at every aspect of life and everything that feeds in to allowing men to believe that they really are superior to women. And I don't mean something ideological here. I mean that their lives are more important, that their lives matter more, that what happens to them matters more. We will never be free unless women are not any longer treated as objects, which includes sexual objects. We are human beings. We are the center of our own lives. We are not things for men to act out on. We will never be free unless we stop the notion that we have in the United States that violence is okay. It's not okay. It's never okay. Nobody has a right to control another human being through violence. And we can't continue to sanction violence as a way of solving problems. Women are not ever going to be free unless all the institutions that support hurting women, I include the use of pornography by men, such that the hurting of women becomes a form of sexual entertainment. I include the exploitation of women in prostitution, such that men have a right to lease women's bodies for sexual release whenever they want. And I include incest, because it seems to me that in incest, we really have here the reigning model of male-female relations. We have a situation of perfect and complete and absolute inequality in which the man is a sovereign and the sexual object has no rights, no choices, no independent existence. We have to deal with the sexualization of children in our society. This is being done because as women have rebelled and have aspired, however we think we failed, to some kind of social equality, men have looked for sex objects who will fit in to a sexual paradigm based on inequality. The question is, can men have sex with equals? The answer may well be no. If the answer is no, the men have to change, or we have to give up equality. I think we should decide not to give up equality. One other thing that has to change is all the people who can't hear the screams have got to start being able to hear them. And those who can't see the breezes have bruises of women in front of them, standing in front of them, have to be able to see them. They also have to have something they can do about it and somewhere they can go when they hear, when they see. I need you to think about the meaning of privacy, the legal meaning and the social meaning, the sense in which a man's home is his castle. And when we talk about privacy for men, we're talking often about power over women and children. And for those of you who are involved in the pro-choice struggle, I want you to think about the notion of privacy as a basis for arguing for our rights over our body. I want to suggest to you that women need to be arguing for equality, not for privacy. That when we talk about privacy, we are colluding in protecting the privacy of men in their homes who hurt women and children. That we need to pursue a different strategy in relation to getting the abortion right. I know many of you do not agree. You are not pro-choice. Some of you are pro-choice. But what I'm talking about here is that every single issue has to be thought through in terms of, what does this mean about male dominance over women and children? Does this reinforce the power of men in the home over women and children? I want to say to you that strong women are also victims. There is nothing about being victimized this way that says anything at all about the character of the woman to whom it happens. That we have a right to resist this unfairness, and that this is a political struggle. Many of you are involved in social services. This is a wider political struggle, because if you do not deal with the things that give men their social and economic power over women, you cannot stop battery from happening. You can take care of one injured woman after another, but you can't stop her from being beaten. And surely those of you who have seen the injuries would rather stop the injuries from happening than simply take care of woman after woman after woman who's been hurt. I want us to use our capacity to bear pain, which I think in women is quite highly developed, in the pursuit of political change. I want us to take all that concern that we have about being made outsiders, being pushed into exile because we don't conform, take it and use it politically. Don't be intimidated by the threats. They can't do anything to you that they haven't already done. You've seen the worst. And finally, I want to say that what's urgent is to make the war against women visible. When it's invisible, we can't fight it. When it's invisible, every single woman is isolated in the trauma of what is happening to her. She has no way out, and she has no way to become whole again. But standing together and seeing the connections in the various kinds of violence against women, and also in the exploitation, it is not overtly violent, we can go up against the power of the batterer, by which I mean the legal system that still protects him, and I mean the society that gives him privileges over us. The woman never wins, but the woman has to win. We have to win. Our lives are at stake here. There is a great sadness in escape without freedom. I want to say that to you. It's terribly sad, but it is very much better than not escaping at all. And I think that the happiness that a woman feels, and in particular a battered woman feels, in feeling self-respect, in being able to live an individual life and make her own decisions from the largest to the smallest, the feeling of joy in self-determination is an overwhelming one, and one that we should talk about, and one that we should share. And finally, I want to say that I thank you for every single day of your lives when you have done something to help any woman who's been battered. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. I'm speaking for so many women, for so many women who would like to say that to you. I'm going to take some questions now. We have some conversation. You have wonderful workshops to attend. The social service people, I beg you to think about the political questions. I beg you to discuss the political questions. The political people, I beg you to think about concrete solutions. And in coming together, we can make a change here. Thank you very much.
Does anybody have their questions written down that we can pass up? How can our movement work to erase our differences and combine our numbers to gain political power, acceptance, and validation in the United States?
And 1 minute. First of all, I'm thrilled by the ambition of the question. I think that the answer is not always to do the thing that is most pleasing. I think that the women's movement in general and the anti-battery movement have the respect that we have, which is really quite considerable. If you think about what people expect from us, expect us to be able to accomplish, because we take stands on principle and because we help women in their real lives. And I don't think that we should be afraid of social conflict. And I don't think that we should be afraid of the names that we're called and the edge of social reaction that often strikes us back, you know, politically. It is terrible to have to go through it, but I think we have to be realistic about social change. And social change involves conflict. We're talking about changing something very big and very deep here. It really hasn't been challenged before. The first wave of feminists wanted very much, if you read their private correspondence, they wanted so much to really be able to talk about marriage, and in particular sexual relations in marriage and battery in public. But they knew that they would be excoriated for doing so, and that the possibility of getting the vote would simply vanish. We have the vote. We've had it for a while. Many of us would argue we haven't made very good use of it. I think that we have to take every opportunity that we have to talk about the real things, and that's how social change happens. And we have differences among ourselves, and we have to talk about those too. In the last 20 years, I've gotten more worried about lying for the sake of social acceptance than I have about letting people see our conflicts. So I keep thinking that common sense plays a role here in how we talk about all of these issues. But I am going to tell you that I don't think that we can make a difference in terms of ending battery or ending rape or ending prostitution. And that's my agenda. That's what I believe in. We can't do those things if we don't talk about the real stuff.
Okay, here's another easy one. What do we do with the knowledge that many, many batterers are adult battered children? What do we do with the perpetrator / victim, the intergenerational abuse of male children as well as female children?
Yeah. Those are two separate questions, and it's important, I think, to keep them separate because we are at this moment in time. And at this moment in time, there are boys who are being victimized, who are being incestuously abused, who are being raped, who are being forced into prostitution. All those things are happening to boys as well as girls. I will tell you that the deeper and wider pornography gets, the more boys will be hurt. Since nobody appears to give a damn about the numbers of women who are being hurt, the pornographers really do encourage incest. They really do promote it. They think it's a really good thing. So accepting pornography sets boys up for abuse, and that's important to understand. I have a lot of trouble with the first part of the question, which has to do with those who are perpetrators, who were victims of battery when they were children. There are things to say about it that I think are valuable. One is, many of them were hurt by their fathers. A fair number of them were hurt by their mothers. It is important, I think, for women not to have to marry and not to have children. And I'm talking about the social imperatives here. I'm not talking about the strategies for achieving that. I'm talking about the social demand that women don't really exist as citizens whom we have to respect if they're not married and with children. I think that we have to do everything we can to cut down the violence wherever it comes from inside the family. But then when we talk about the adult male perpetrator, this is where I, as somebody who has had the experience of being battered, I go blank. Because I don't know any solution except jail. Women who have killed in self-defense, I think it's important to support them. I think it's important politically to support battered women who kill the men who are hurting them. We haven't found ways of changing men who hurt women, whether they're batterers or rapists or whether they rape children. We haven't found ways of making them different. And so the only recourse that we have is to take them away from the rest of us and try to make the kinds of social changes that won't produce them in the first place. And I think that's just realistic. Not happy making, but realistic.
What do you do with the phenomenon of battering between women in lesbian relationships?
It's very important that it be acknowledged and addressed. I think that the crisis that it presents for the women's movement, frankly, is not in terms of the partner who's being battered, it's in terms of the partner who's doing the battering, which very little attention has been being paid to. When we talk about male violence, many of us have said over and over and over and over again, we don't think that we're talking about any kind of biological inevitability. That's why we believe that this can be changed through social means, through changing society. It is not surprising to find that there are women who are violent in relationships. If you look at violence as a function of power over another human being, and I think that that's part of the importance of including lesbian battering in everything that we do, because it reminds us of that, also because of the importance of the lives of the women that are being destroyed. And maybe this is a bridge in some way to the last question, to try to find solutions that will in fact change the behavior of the batterer. I'm not sure.
How can you talk to a battered woman about her wanting to go back?
It's unbelievably difficult, as you know. And the reason is that her fear of the batterer is so incredibly deep that she can't express it to you. She can't tell you that you think it's magical and irrational, but she knows it's not. He is going to find her. He is going to hurt her. It is going to happen. And the only chance she has in the world is to try to propitiate him in some way or another. And the thing that's so shocking about this is that, you know, battered women who can will tell you that the man is going to kill them after they've left. And people treat it as if it's illogical and irrational. And as I say, now we have 10 years of some experience in dealing with women who have been battered, and we know that more women are killed after they leave than when they stay, percentage-wise. So it's the truth. It's the truth that she's in terrible, terrible danger when she leaves. And if you can't give her safety, you can't give her a reason not to go back, because she has a sudden perception that he's going to kill her, and she's probably right. It's horrible. And what are we talking about here? We're talking about a form of abuse that, as long as people continue to tolerate it, there really isn't going to be any solution that we can call a real escape. And so that's part of the reason that I'm suggesting to you, at some point the woman will decide that she'd rather, and this is horrible, she will decide that she'd rather be dead. And at the point that she decides that she would rather be dead, it is very likely that that is when she will really leave and stay away. And then there's the chance that she will really be dead.
What do you believe the effect of the far right to be on present and future U.S. society? I refer to Falwell, Phyllis Schlafly, the Buchanans, etc.
I'd like to answer it in relation to battery, if I could. to try to focus it in that way. Several years ago, maybe it was 10 years ago, in New Hampshire, the Committee on the Status of Women was taken over by this particular political faction. And women were labeled by the state of New Hampshire. Women who ran away were labeled, the way that slaves used to be labeled when they ran away. And they were fugitives. They were punitively labeled by the state for deserting their families. And we were told that battery wasn't a real thing, and that these women weren't escaping, but that instead what we were dealing with was a feminist plot, again, to destroy the family. I think that most of us know that battery takes place along the whole political spectrum, as all these crimes against women do. All right, and the left has their way of protecting the men who commit the crimes, and the right has their way of protecting the men who commit the crimes. And I think that where I see all of us as having to stand up against what I would call the far right ideology is in this, that no woman should give a superior value to her family than to her own life. That if the family cannot accommodate the safety and dignity of women, that particular family should not exist as a family. And we have to make it possible for women to live on our own with our children in conditions of safety until maybe men find a way to live without hurting us.
Okay, one last question. How can we stop pornography through policy and legislation and also protect the First Amendment freedom of speech?
It's a very important question. As many of you will know, Catherine McKinnon, who's a constitutional lawyer, and myself, who's a citizen, drafted a model form of civil rights legislation in the city of Minneapolis, a very progressive city, in which there was a very concrete and specific definition of pornography, and then civil causes of action, so that if a woman were coerced into pornography, she could sue whoever had coerced her, but also the whole chain of profit. With pornography, we're almost always talking about organized crime, at least in the distribution, now that we have more amateurs actually making the product. And you will see pornography being made of battered women. You will see this as part of sexual abuse inside homes now. I think that our civil rights bill is the best way to approach the pornography industry and at the same time respect the rights of political expression, literary expression, and sexual expression. Now, in order to believe that, you have to think that sex is not inherently brutalizing of women. If you think that pornography is in fact simply one part of sex, and if you think that, for instance, male domination is part of sex, then you're going to believe that anything that's done against pornography is something that's going to be done against sexual expression. But if you're fighting for a world in which there's equality and in which sex has something to do with not just expression but communication, then it seems to me that if we hold the pornographers responsible for the harms that they do to women, and we can have women who are hurt go into court and get money damages, since money is all the pornographers care about, we can significantly at least reduce the reach of the pornography industry in this country. And I have to say to you that when incest and homelessness join up with female poverty, that's where most of the population of women in pornography come from. So we're talking about a crime against women in terms of the way the pornography is made, and then, as you know, the way it's used in sexual abuse. And we simply can't say that it's all right. It's not all right. It hurts women. We have legal options We also have social options, and those social options are important, which is to say, I hope you will keep track of the way that pornography is used in battering of women. It's very important, it's very significant, and you need to talk about it, you need to let people know about it. That will help. But the whole issue here is harm to women and not repression of speech or ideas. Thank you very much. You've been very, very kind. Thank you.
Okay, Andrea will be over by Bookwoman, if for any additional questions during the break before lunch. I need everybody to clear out as quickly as possible.
Get out of your way. Just